Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have back with me today the one and only Dr. Lee Goodell. Dr. Goodell, as listeners will remember, I'm sure, is a cardiac anesthesiologist and an intensivist and the program director for our critical care fellowship here at Johns Hopkins, and most importantly, a stellar all-around guy. It's a pleasure to have him back on the show. We're going to talk about fluid responsiveness, one of the most requested topics from the audience. And Lee, I'm so happy that you were able to do this. Welcome back to the show.
Jed, it's great to be back and to be with all of your listeners. Always fun to talk and join ACRAC.
Awesome. So let's jump right in. We're going to talk about fluid responsiveness. So let me ask you off the top, what do we mean? When we say, is a patient fluid responsive, what does that mean? How would you define it?
So I'm going to pause right there and set some groundwork and maybe some ground rules.
Please do.
So all of you excited about fluid responsiveness are ultimately honed in on the right practice, and that is thoughtful hemodynamic management of your patients undergoing anesthesia in critical care. Fluid responsiveness is a huge part of that, and continuing to evaluate your patient for fluid responsiveness. But the ground rules, I think, are these. So first of all, we're going to otherwise clarify evaluations of fluid responsiveness and some of the caveats, the pitfalls. But before we even go there, for the entire conversation, hemodynamic management at its base and core is determined by cardiac output, by vascular tone, by volume status. And when we start to talk about fluid responsiveness, before I give you that definition, we're going to start by talking about patients with normal heart function. I think it's really important to start there because you could potentially really harm someone if you just try to apply a blanket assessment of fluid responsiveness to patients of all types of cardiac function. So that's the first place I wanted to start with. So
we're going to make sense. And Lee, I always appreciate how you are very careful with kind of what you lay out there. I remember when we talked about POCUS, and I asked you, I think about if a left heart looks like it's collapsing on echo, does that tell you that the patient can use some fluid? And I remember you saying, whoa, we definitely can't, right? Like, we got to talk about all the other things that could be. So I appreciate you being very careful, and I know the audience does too. All right, so we want to be very careful to say we're going to give some general rules during the course of this discussion for kind of evaluating, or some general guidelines, practices for evaluating fluid responsiveness. But what you're emphasizing is that these are not, can't be blanket applied in a blanket fashion to all patients. We're talking about patients with normal heart function and some other parameters as well.
Yeah. And I think as the listeners learn more about these topics, you can learn how they might be applicable to these other situations. I think afterload or vascular tone is also a really important thing that that even the articles we're going to provide you to further read on this subject don't start with. So fluid responsiveness is going to fluctuate based on vascular tone as well. So so I think that's a second sort of ground rule to think about. You want your vascular tone to ideally be normal, but as we know from anesthesia, that's often not the case because our anesthetics directly impact that. So you might even have lower vascular tone, but when you're evaluating for fluid responsiveness from point A to point B, you want to try to assess the fact that vascular tone is consistent between those two time points. All right. So hopefully I haven't confused you with starting, but set some ground rules. Now, fluid responsiveness. So essentially, the concept of fluid responsiveness is that the patient requires augmentation of their cardiac output to maintain or improve their perfusion state. And then the second aspect of that is that additional volume resuscitation is going to achieve that. So they will respond by additional fluid.
So when we say respond, we mean increase cardiac output to increase perfusion.
That's correct.
Okay. And I think that's really key, right? Because a lot of people are under the impression that an increase in blood pressure with fluid administration indicates fluid responsiveness. And that is not what you just said. That is not the definition that we're going to use, right?
So this is one of my favorite things to think overall about anesthesia practice, again, is that we are so focused on the numbers of the blood pressure. But those reflect cardiac output for sure, but they also reflect those other things that I mentioned before, in afterload and tone. So exactly. We aim to increase the cardiac output, which is not necessarily the numbers, although that's the numbers being what we often use as one of the markers of increased cardiac output, but we're going to augment cardiac output with additional fluid. And then that is a responder. That is someone who's a fluid responder.
Great. So and when we do this, we're trying to figure out, is somebody going to have that response, that increased cardiac output, increased perfusion with fluid, as opposed to giving fluid in someone who may not have that response we're looking for. And so that differs, right, than the kind of traditional. I mean, I think you probably and I both were taught at a time when we were told, look, you use the 4-2-1 rule to calculate a fluid deficit, give that back over the first hour of the case, and then run maintenance fluid and give, you know, there was no, when I was initially taught kind of fluid management for the OR, I was not taught anything about using dynamic variables. It was just calculate the fluid that they don't have and put it in them. And this is very different, right? This is trying to figure out, will they respond to fluid?
Correct.
All right. So Lee, why do we care? And what I mean is, what are the downsides of giving too much fluid? Why don't we just give a bunch of fluid and, you know, say, well, hey, if some is good, more is better?
So this is referred to as really a liberal fluid management strategy, and has been related to increased complications and worse patient outcome. We could spend a lot of time going through those studies in detail. But this does get back to a little bit of the previous approach that we were taught during residency of trying to use that 4-2-1 rule and significantly resuscitate folks. I guess what will further frustrate the listeners is that, in response to some of those studies, more restrictive strategies were used to achieve really zero fluid balance over the course of different abdominal surgery cases, and there have also been problems there leading to acute kidney injury and other complication rates with excess fluid. Some of those studies showed complications with bowel anastomoses, fluid overload, things that would logically make sense. So ideally what's prescribed now sort of in our national guidelines is sort of a medium path. And a lot of people prescribe fluid responsiveness as a way to try to find that middle path.
Yeah. Thanks, Lee. I think that's great. And you know, that's, I laugh because that's kind of what we want, right? Is not too little, not too much. We want it just right. And that is essentially what the data suggests, is that too little is not great. Too much is definitely not great. And what you want is to have it just right, which is, as you say, the whole point of trying to have some techniques, some tools we can use to figure out whether the patient would benefit from some fluid. And I will say that if listeners haven't checked them out already, they can check out the couple of ERAS podcasts that we've done. One was with Chris Wu, one was with Mike Grant, and those cover some of the reasons why ERAS pathways try to limit fluid to an extent. All right, so let's talk about how we actually do this now. We're going to talk mostly about the operating room, and we may, you know, do a whole nother episode specific to the ICU. But in the operating room, Lee, how do we figure out if someone is fluid responsive?
So we have a lot of control in the operating room, and I think that's one reason why Jed and I aim to differentiate between the two environments. Not that we don't have control all the time in the ICU, but it's obviously just very different when you have general anesthesia, you have mechanical ventilation, and usually paralysis in most situations. So there are multiple ways that we assess fluid responsiveness. One is sort of an age-old technique. You give fluid and you see what happens. So essentially, you can give fluid bolusing and see if you have a response. That response we're usually going to see in the operating room is increase in the numbers on the blood pressure. But again, I take the opportunity for us to all think harder that we believe that's mediated by an increase in cardiac output. And if the vascular tone is low, we might not see that. So is that someone who's not responding? If their blood pressure doesn't go up, it's possible. It might mean then that you need to address their vascular tone. But it might be that volume status and fluid resuscitation is not the answer in that circumstance. So, and we'd worry then that was excess fluid that didn't need to be given. So that's one of the first ways to assess fluid responsiveness. But I think the practice now is shifting to, can we use some of these other dynamic indices prior to going straight to fluid and maybe try to predict what's going to happen? And that's the majority of the body of literature that I think we otherwise wanted to summarize and discuss with you today.
Yeah, thanks, Lee. And, you know, as you could imagine, if you go with the route of giving a fluid bolus and assessing response, imagine a 12-hour case in the operating room where you're doing that every 15, 20 minutes to try to figure out if they're fluid responsive. You're going to give a lot of volume just in those boluses, just in your tests over the course of that case. So, you know, there are downsides to that. So, as you say, let's talk about kind of the dynamic variables that we can look at and how those can help us. So what are the things we look at to try to get an idea without giving fluid as to whether a patient would benefit from getting fluid?
So I think we're talking mostly about big cases and oftentimes when you're going to have an arterial line. So let's spend time talking really about that and what utility we can gain from that arterial line and really the waveform analysis in rudimentary terms. So first, the ground rules for this analysis, and this is why I mentioned that the OR really provides us a really useful environment. So in the setting, when you're mechanically ventilated, paralyzed, no arrhythmia, no right heart failure, those conditions really make the arterial line waveform remarkably useful in the following ways. So the most evidence-based and validated number is pulse pressure variation between breathing. And that's essentially the difference in amplitude of the pulse pressure between breaths. And essentially greater than 12% variation is the most predictive measure of the following arterial line measures and analyses that we'll discuss. It is the most predictive of fluid responsiveness.
And is there a certain cutoff, Lee? When we're saying we want to look at pulse pressure variation, how much variation is predictive of fluid responsiveness?
So greater than 12% is it has been most predictive. If it's between 9 and sort of 12%, then it can be a gray zone, so to speak. So I think then you also have to consider the clinical picture and what's going on and not use these numbers in isolation.
Sure. Okay. But that's helpful to have a kind of guideline. 12%, obviously the higher the percentage, the more sure you can be, though never, none of this is going to give you 100% certainty, as you say. Okay. So pulse pressure variation, most well validated, most predictive. And as you said, that's the change in pulse pressure, which is of course systolic minus diastolic from, with respiratory variation. Okay. So that's one thing folks can look at. What else?
So the next reference is stroke volume variation. And if you are able to take the area under the curve of the arterial waveform, that is going to correlate to stroke volume. So the area itself under the if you were able to calculate in real time, which I would love to see you do, is going to correlate, as I said, to stroke volume. So if you see variation in that around 10%, then that's also seen to be predictive. But you know, with both of these two numbers, they're both helpful. So pulse pressure variation being the most predictive, but they're both pretty laborious to calculate. You know, I have no connection to any industry. And this industry provider that provide these technologies, but these two almost do require the investment of another device that requires upkeep, et cetera, in the operating room. Maybe one of my favorites is systolic pressure variation, and the studies demonstrate that its reliability and prediction is about the same as stroke volume variation, not quite as good as pulse pressure variation, but also really useful. And I think in any OR where you have an arterial waveform, you can decrease the sweep on the tracing and make a pretty good guess if the difference is greater than 8 to 10 millimeters of mercury with breathing. Suggestive of hypovolemia. So we teach our residents to use this a decent amount, not as, you know, an absolute indication for fluid, but certainly as part of your assessment in the operating room.
And Lee, so those are three great variables to use. You mentioned a bunch of necessary precursors to being able to rely on these: sinus rhythm, no right heart failure, mechanical ventilation, ideally neuromuscular blockade. What about tidal volume? Is it true that we can't, these are not as accurate with low tidal volume, and ideally we would have a higher tidal volume?
That is a great point. And a lot of the studies that have been done with these numbers demonstrate that a tidal volume of around 8 cc's per kilo is probably necessary to actually even use these indices with the numbers that I quoted, which hopefully makes everybody a little uneasy that doesn't really connect with lung protective ventilation, both in the ICU that's been translated into some pretty good outcomes data in the operating room. So it might be something that you consider temporarily doing as sort of a test, which is a little bit of where the science is now that we'll talk maybe a little bit more about of with echo and volume assessment in the ICU.
Great. So, you know, what I do, and I know a lot of folks do, is I keep folks, if I can, at 6 cc's per kilo predicted body weight for the case in the operating room. But then if I want to look at these variables, I'll put them up to 8 cc's for a minute or two to get a feel for the systolic pressure variation, and then I will go back to 6. And I think that it's probably reasonably safe to do that a minute or two at a slightly higher tidal volume is probably not going to cause a lot of harm. don't know if you do that similarly, Lee, or if you have a different approach.
I think if I really need that additional information, I certainly will. What I was alluding to in the ICU is that now there are techniques to do similar things with that using echocardiographic changes as well, while doing different types of changes to the inspiratory system. And I think, Jed, I think this might be a good opportunity actually for me to take a shot for everyone to really describe the physiologic concepts that are driving these pieces of data that we're trying to apply clinically.
Yeah, please do. I think that would be really helpful.
You know, I think this for me as a resident and even as a fellow, it was hard to wrap my mind around this. And hopefully I can provide you at least a window into my understanding. And there's a paper that we've attached to this podcast that also can help you dive into the physiology. So clearly we're seeing differential blood pressures, different cardiac output that's happening on a breath to breath or even inspiratory to expiratory cycle change. And let's just break that down and follow blood flow. This to me is the easiest way to remember it. So with positive pressure ventilation, and everything changes actually if we start talking spontaneous ventilation, but we're talking only about positive pressure ventilation. So with that mechanically delivered breath, you're going to increase your thoracic pressure and decrease preload to the right ventricle. In that instant, the right ventricle is going to have less blood. But what was so confusing to me until I explain here in a second how to understand this is that in that very minute too, when you have increased intrathoracic pressure, you actually have an instantaneous increase in left ventricular preload. So in that first beat, you have increased LV preload. You also have increased intrathoracic pressure that helps LV systolic function. So, and this seems very confusing. Hopefully I haven't lost anybody so far. Believe me, this took me a while to wrap my head around. But in that moment, you actually are going to have increased LV ejection because essentially the decrease in right ventricular preload hasn't yet affected left ventricular output. Okay. So as inspiration continues, preload further drops into the RV. So the RV ejects less, and because of ventricular interdependence, the left heart can't eject what the right heart doesn't bring it. Then you start to have decreases in left ventricular preload at that point because of the increases in intrathoracic pressure. So by saying someone is hypovolemic, if someone is hypovolemic, it will exaggerate that ultimate decrease of left ventricular ejection during inspiration. And so what we are seeing manifested on the arterial waveform or in these three different measurements is essentially changes in cardiac output over the course of those couple breaths.
I think that's super well said, Lee, and really a nice way for people to understand it because I agree with you. I think a lot of people know the fact that respiratory variation in an arterial line waveform can indicate volume responsiveness, but they don't know why, and that is why. So thank you for taking us through that. All right. So I want to touch on one other thing. You mentioned that you know, for these cases that we're talking, generally these big cases that we're going to be really thinking about fluid intensively, we are likely to have an arterial line. Now, if we don't, there is something called the plethysmographic variability index. And that is something you can get from a pulse oximeter. Tell me a little about that. Is that helpful? What do we do with that?
Yeah. So I think that, this can be really useful in cases where you don't have that arterial line, and is now also being applied in some of those industry technologies to assess for cardiac output. And so essentially, it's also a variability of about 14% is a predictor of fluid responsiveness. But I'd say one caveat is it is further affected by other changes in vasomotor tone with some of those caveats that I mentioned before. And that makes sense, as you might expect, as we're assessing at the level of a digit where you typically have a pulse ox. I think this probably less reliable than the others, but certainly could still give you useful information. I think particularly if you have wide variability in the index.
Great. Now, what about if you could get a transthoracic echo probe on a patient's chest? And I'm imagining maybe like pelvic surgery, if you needed to, you probably could get under the drapes and put a probe on the chest. What, maybe, and again, we'll talk, I think if we do another episode talking about kind of what we might do in the ICU, which will be more echo focused. But if you were going to do this, just give us a brief, like what would you look for and how helpful is that if you could get a probe on the chest?
So very useful. I think the first thing it gives you insight on, or where I started this discussion, that if your blood pressure appears lower than it should, you first can identify ventricular function. You can identify the presence of an effusion. Looking at volume in particular, I think it would be useful to look at the inferior vena cava. That's often pretty difficult in abdominal surgery, as you mentioned. I think that looking at left ventricular end diastolic area and end systolic area, the difference can guide you. I do offer some caveats to that, and I think I think that it certainly needs additional training before you're using that as a predictor of volume responsive of fluid responsiveness in particular, because some of the data from the operating room suggests that can mislead people.
Great. All right. And this is rare, right? We're very rarely going to be putting a probe on a patient in the operating room, especially, as you say, during an abdominal case, and obviously impossible during a thoracic case. So most of these cases that we're going to be really kind of very tightly thinking about volume status over a long, multiple hours, we're going to have an arterial line. And if you don't, the pulse ox can give you some information, as we've discussed. Interestingly, one of the articles we're going to post in the show notes is from anesthesiology, and talks about, it's a nice overview of this topic. And it mentioned a couple of newer variables that I just thought were interesting. One is an end expiratory occlusion test, and one is a tidal volume challenge. And the tidal volume challenge is not that, kind of fancy. It's really just saying going up from 6 to 8 mLs per kilo for a minute and seeing if you see a change in these variables, which is kind of what we already talked about. The end expiratory occlusion test I thought was interesting. I don't know if you've ever done this, Lee, but I have not. I hadn't heard of it. But the idea here, I guess, is to interrupt the vent, so stop the vent for up to 15 to 30 seconds at the end of expiration, and then assess changes in cardiac output with the variables we talked about to see what happens. And the idea here being that normally, when that new breath would happen, you'd see all the changes that you mentioned. You'd see that initial increase and then decrease in left ventricular output. But if that doesn't happen, then you kind of almost simulate an increase in left ventricular filling because you skip the decrease. So it's almost like a double negative, and you don't decrease, so you increase. And then you can see if you, it's almost like giving a bolus, right? And see what the response is. Those have been, you know, I think very recently described. So there's probably not a lot out about it yet, but I thought those were interesting. Any thoughts on those?
There has been some similar work done in the ICU using some of the similar methodology, and you know, what we'll talk about hopefully in the ICU is using LVOT, basically blood flow and ejection, and assessing, you know, beat to beat differences between those. And so I think some of that practice originated from that in the ICU. And I think it definitely could be useful. I think the other important thing that probably folks are thinking about is how do we make it and keep it safe? I think it's exciting for us to have these other techniques and to be really thoughtful. I'm looking forward to seeing how our specialty really utilizes them to be more thoughtful. But I would bring that safety caveat as well. Not even the fact that we're manipulating ventilation pressures and maybe even taking someone off the vent, which has issues. But also the fact that, the art of anesthesia is multitasking and making sure that we're not anchoring on fluid responsiveness alone while we're doing that. I think that's possible, but I would just, as people are excited to learn about these different techniques, I hope you maintain attention elsewhere as well.
Absolutely. All right. So Lee, let me ask you, is there ever a time when you would give fluid to a patient in the operating room if they're not meeting criteria for being fluid responsive? So let's say you've got a patient and, you know, you check their systolic pressure variation and it's 5%. And is there a time when you would say, well, yeah, okay, but I'm going to give fluid anyway?
So I think it's a really useful question. And it gets back to the fact that you can't make these decisions in a vacuum. I think you have to take all of the clinical data you have in front of you. I would also really like to know, what my sense of a patient's afterload is, what I've given them since then. I think that we have to be doubtful, if we think a patient's bleeding and might have an acute increase in afterload as a response to that, a physiologic afterload, these numbers are not going to behave as we're teaching you today. And I would challenge you to just do a full hemodynamic assessment. One of the other things that we didn't talk about is that, looking at other indices of adequate cardiac output. That can include a lot of other things, just a pulse ox waveform. If your pulse ox is not giving you a reliable waveform, it very well might be that the fingers aren't getting blood flow. You might have a normal-ish number for your systolic, diastolic, and mean, but that the body is reacting to something that you're not sure of. So I would pump the brakes and think broadly. But very much consider if I felt then after doing all that, that maybe fluid is indicated even with normal non-responder predictive numbers.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Lee. I think that these are helpful, but as you say, these are not existing in isolation. You need to take this as these indicators as one piece of a much broader puzzle and think it through. All right. So let me ask you, if a patient isn't fluid responsive, either they're not meeting the criteria we've discussed, or you actually try and then you don't get the result you want with fluid, does that mean they're pressor responsive? Maybe. Is there any way to figure that out? Or do we just have to try some afterload with norepinephrine or something like it and see if that helps?
I think it's reasonable to try phenylephrine in that setting. Address really how much anesthesia a patient's receiving at that point. Sometimes you might be deeper than you think with anesthesia. And then I think we really also need to consider cardiomyopathy, whether an acute change there, or a chronically undiagnosed situation. And so you said earlier, it's unlikely for us to put a transthoracic probe on in the middle of the operating room. It's a little bit of one of my missions in my role in education and research to hopefully change that and make this technology really available to people dealing with these issues in the operating room, and to deal with them within our scope of practice.
Awesome. That was actually my last question for you, was what the future holds. So it sounds like there's some exciting stuff you're involved with on the horizon. Anything else you think of that you know, in 20 years, how are we going to be assessing volume responsiveness in the OR?
Yeah, I would actually go straight there and just say a little bit more that I really hope to be part of our general anesthesiology specialty that helps us to really define what an appropriate scope of practice is for cardiac POCUS, that our scope is within our skill set, but really complements the fact that we are masters of the hemodynamics, and we are the ones that deal with these issues every day in a level of granularity that no one else does. And that's one reason we love it.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's going to be exciting to see, Lee, and certainly appreciate you being involved in trying to make echo assessment and the accessibility of this stuff in the operating room to general anesthesiologists more available in the future. All right. Well, this has been a really informative discussion. Let's turn to the portion of our podcast where we talk about random recommendations for the audience. It's still the time of COVID. Folks are still not doing the same kind of traveling and outdoor, or I should say kind of activities and certainly indoors that they may typically be doing. And with the weather getting colder, maybe less outdoor stuff too. So I'm sure people would appreciate any recommendations you have of what's been keeping you occupied, and other than maybe hanging out with your kids, which I know you do. So let me know, what do you have for the audience?
Well, you're right. My small kids and my wife are my every reason for getting up every day. I'll tell you, diving back into Harry Potter as an adult and feeling like a kid every day with my son and the world of magic is definitely been something I look forward to every day.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I a couple years ago read the Harry Potter books, start to finish, all of them, to my two older daughters, and man, they liked it, but I think I liked it more. It was really
fun. I know. I don't want to let I think my son knows how much I like it, but it's there's so much more stuff now than there even was when we, you know, a while back. You know, for instance, there's cookbooks now with all the Harry Potter stuff, and Legos, man, let me tell you, if you haven't seen the Lego Hogwarts castle, and you just want to feel like you want to be a kid again right now, go ahead and Google that. And, you might even find yourself doing some Legos during your anesthesia residency. And, I'd love to see a picture of it.
That sounds awesome. Well, thanks, Lee. My random recommendation for the day is, and I'm almost embarrassed to say it because I may be the last person on earth to not have watched this show, but I finally have gotten around to watching Schitt's Creek, which is one of the funnier shows I have ever watched. And I love that it's short. So the episodes are about 22 minutes, which, it's really easily digestible. So if I've just want to take a break from work or something, and I can, got 20 minutes free, I can watch an episode. My wife had actually watched it at the gym without me, which is fine, of course. And so now I'm trying to catch up to her. So I'm just watching it whenever I get a sec, but the show is really funny. So highly recommend that to anyone who is like me behind the times. All right, Lee, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure.
All right. That was great. Hopefully people found that useful. I know this was a really requested topic, so I hope you found it to be what you were hoping. If you have comments, go to the website, acrac.com. You can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you would like to join the conversation on Twitter, I'm at Jay Wolpaw, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And there's also an ACRAC Facebook group that you are welcome to join. If you're a fan of the show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. And if you would like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC, or you can make a donation anytime by going to Venmo and looking for Jay Wolpaw, or going to paypal.me/ACRAC. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. Thank you, as always, to Dr. Brian Park, our tech lead, to April Liu, our social media manager, and to Dr. Kimmy Akash Cooley, our prior social media manager and still a valuable member of the team. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo, and you can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Lee Goodell, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.